People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we look at the ongoing battle between the Pacifica Radio Network and its flagship station, KPFA, in Berkeley, California, with our guest, Khalil Jacobs-Fantauzi.
As we've seen recently, that the people that have began to partake in creating the leadership of Pacifica are people that don't at all see the vision as it was created. And what's happened recently is that they don't see the vision as we at KPFA or the majority of people within the community of KPFA see the vision as. So we have individuals that are in high positions within the organization of Pacifica, Mary Frances Berry, Lynn Chadwick, people within the leadership that are not in touch, number one, with the people, and as we have seen, don't have any regard necessary for what the people think and want.
And Martin Lee, author of the book The Beast Reawakens, discusses fascist politician Jörg Haider.
Jörg Haider is the leader of the Freedom Party in Austria. The Freedom Party is a radical right-wing populist party which has openly fascist roots. As a result of a recent election in Austria, it has come to share power in a national governing coalition. And this is a very disconcerting and disturbing development to my mind, because what it does, it really legitimizes a very vicious kind of extremism, because Haider's political party really campaigned by scapegoating foreigners, scapegoating immigrants, in a way that was really out of proportion to any kind of reality. He blamed foreigners for every problem under the sun in Austria. He blamed them for juvenile delinquency and drug abuse and joblessness and prostitution, any problem under the sun. And he managed to win power as a result of by brokering a deal with the mainstream conservative party in Austria, the People's Party. And now he'll be in the government.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Khalil Jacobs-Fantauzi was one of the leaders of the street protests last year during the battles to take back KPFA from the Pacifica Foundation. Khalil Jacobs-Fantauzi is also the only remaining member of the protesting groups who is facing legal charges and possible imprisonment. Khalil Jacobs-Fantauzi was interviewed by Steve Miller for People's Tribune Radio in Oakland, California. Jacobs-Fantauzi begins by discussing KPFA, the flagship station of the Pacifica Radio Network.
KPFA is a community radio station that was started in the 1950s with the whole idea of pacifists, giving a voice to the voiceless, community radio that's not connected to corporate entities, that is really able to give people, the community, an alternate voice, an alternate idea, an alternate way of communicating with each other. And as we've seen recently, that the people that have began to partake in creating the leadership of Pacifica are people that don't at all see the vision as it was created. And what's happened recently is that they don't see the vision as we at KPFA or the majority of people within the community of KPFA see the vision as. So we have individuals that are in high positions within the organization of Pacifica, Mary Frances Berry, Lynn Chadwick, people within the leadership that are not in touch, number one, with the people, and as we have seen, don't have any regard necessary for what the people think and want. And so I'm on the local advisory board of KPFA, and I'm a community activist and a youth activist. And so when I saw what was happening, and when I saw the censorship, and when I saw people having no regard for the idea of community radio or the idea of community being involved in the decision making or the democratization of the radio station, it became something for me that I held close to my heart and what I find is an important thing as an activist. And so a lot of us became involved in different ways, in different levels, when it became a battle on the streets, when people were locked out of the station and did no longer have access to what they did, which was a lot of people that are radio programmers, which is not, does not necessarily mean that they were activists or that they know how to partake in political activities. So at that time, I think that the community activist role played a very key role, you know, part in the struggle to regain access to the radio station, because a lot of people have more experience with dealing with police. So I think that, you know, it was the community activist played a very important role in the struggle.
So you think that the role of young people and the community was a real fundamental issue here?
Definitely. It definitely was through the strong support of the community that the struggle, the first stage in the battle, getting back in the station, was victorious and won.
Where do you think this battle is going from this point now?
First of all, it's really, a lot of the time people get stuck in looking at it as a local issue. Oh, you know, this is KPFA, we're the Bay Area, this is California, this is relevant to us. And I definitely see it in a national perspective and international perspective. It's important to understand that Pacifica owns, you know, there's five stations in the network. That's Texas, that's LA, that's New York, that's DC, and, you know, and Berkeley. So we definitely have to see it within the context of that, like, this is one of the only networks of radio, a voice that is not connected to corporate America directly, that does not take funding, sponsorship from Chevron. So therefore it can have people like Dennis Bernstein and Black Coins talk about Chevron without having to worry about the repercussions. I think that that's also the danger, that when you have this type of entity, Pacifica, you know, a free speech community radio, censoring an issue which is talking about itself, censoring the issues that are going on with Pacifica, you have a real danger of the whole idea of what is their vision, and why are they no longer holding true to that vision.
Clearly the battle isn't over.
Things are happening full speed. It's just that the coverage, people are not becoming aware of what's happening. In the middle of the night, in under darkness,
right,
they decide to move offices, and they move from the Bay Area where they started, where the whole, you know, idea of Pacifica came from, and they move to the belly of the beast even deeper, you know, Washington, D.C. The most, you know, recent thing is the firing of the national news director, and because of his dedication to covering issues and not being censored. This last Monday was a start of a strike. I think it's over 40 stringers. The people that do different segments of Pacifica National News have gone on strike and said that they're no longer willing to submit information to the network until these policies of censorship are done away with. Within the scheme of things, there is plans. I don't know exactly who is the one that's calling the shots. I think Mary Frances Berry definitely has a role in it, but I don't know where the calls are coming from. And I see that they're definitely trying to manipulate the situation. And whether that manipulation is to, you know, just make this Pacifica network sink into the ground, or whether they want to sell it for a huge fee, or whether they just want to lose credibility of it, I think that all of those outcomes are very harmful for what, you know, we as a nation need, which is alternative voices. People be given access to information and spreading information that is not connected to mainstream media. And so I think that, you know, that's why we as people that are activists and as people that are that see the significance and importance of having a national network of you know, of alternative information and media, have to be ready to take a stand on these issues.
3 years ago, the new Federal Communications Act was passed. It was really clear at that time that they were just putting the whole radio waves, the whole electromagnetic spectrum up for sale. How do you see the connection between this and what's happened at KPFA?
I definitely see. Well, for me, it's about liberating ways of communicating, liberating forms of communication. So I think when you talk about micropower radio, there's a definite correlation, because that's other possibilities and ways of spreading information that's not connected to mainstream and corporate America. So I see that the roles are very similar. And as you can see, a lot of the activists that are involved in, you know, demanding democracy and and demanding free speech and no censorship at the KPFA level are also activists in the micro radio realm. But I think that there's a significant step that needs to be made to make that this whole movement of micro power radio connect with urban communities and connect and become something that young people see as an alternative. And I think that, you know, with what is happening with, you know, mainstream media and, you know, people using hip hop and corporate America digesting it and spitting it out how they want to, I think that young people are definitely, you know, are confused. And I think that the masses are listening to KMEL rather than saying, wow, we can create an alternative way of communicating. So I think that as a movement of micropower radio and as a movement of alternative radio, we need to really think about ways of reaching more people, reaching the masses, and getting them involved authentically in the struggle.
Everybody should know that of all the people who were arrested, you're about the only guy who's been singled out for real serious persecution. Could you let us know the status of what's going on and why you think they singled you out?
Okay. Well, I was arrested on July 21st. At around 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was during a time where I was playing the role of police liaison, which I was doing for a lot of the time, which means that I was communicating with the police and the protesters to try and make sure that there was a level of communication and so that there would be a level of peace, and that's really what our intentions were, was to have a nonviolent political action. And what happened was the police felt that I was too, they use the word arrogant, or I was too sure of myself and my dealings with them. And so they wanted to kind of teach me a lesson. So I was arrested for obstructing an officer of the peace, 148 in the penal code, and I'm facing a misdemeanor charge with a maximum penalty of a 1 year in jail, possible $1,000 fine at the maximum. That's what it could be. And I think that, you know, we've seen that they've dropped the charges, rightfully so, amongst all other protesters, or gave them time served for the time that they were in for the couple hours of the morning. And at the time of my arrest, from the very, you know, inclination at the beginning, I was treated differently. I was not, you know, asked to peacefully, you know, you're under arrest, this is what you're under arrest for. I've never read my rights. They refused to give me a phone call. They lifted me up violently by my arms, threw me into a paddy wagon head first. They took me to Santa Rita County Jail after taking me to Berkeley because I asked for medical attention. And so they're like, okay, we'll give you attention. And they threw me to the county jail. They released me on bail, which we community people had to come up with funds. And they definitely the entire time were trying to do this as a way of like trying to teach, like take the one of the leaders of the people that were involved in Camp KPFA and trying to like show other people through how they treated me that, you know, this will not be tolerated, that we will not have these type of deviancies. The reason why I feel that I was chosen, you know, number one, I think we need to look at it within the context of what's happening in this country. Young people of color, political activists have been targeted and are being targeted, right? We have Proposition 21, which is targeting throwing 13 and 14 year old kids into adult prisons, called the Youth Gang Prevention Act. So we see that, you know, across the country, people are trying to blame, have a scapegoat, blame young people, and see all young people as these criminal, kind of very violent, threatening people. And also I think that, you know, the fact that I've been involved in some of the other struggles, whether it be around the activist, you know, work that I do with Puerto Rico and the liberation of Puerto Rico and the political prisoners, or whether it be around the work that we are doing at UC Berkeley, which was, you know, against Proposition 187 or 209, taking away affirmative action. So I have been arrested several other times for peaceful protests, and I've never been convicted because they've all been things that have been minor, and I've been peaceful, and it's been for political protests. So I think that that's part of the reason why they've chosen to go after me particularly. I think that a lot of people are not connected to activism, so therefore they think it's on a decline. They think that the high times were like the 60s, and there's nothing that we can take away from other time periods in social movements because there's amazing things that have been done. But I think that as being a person who's connected to a lot of young activists in the Bay Area, you know, last year or a year and a half ago when 5 or 6,000 young people in the Bay Area decided that that bilingual education was a right, that people had a right to education, and that people should be looking at funding schools and not jails, that they mobilized in a serious way. And it wasn't the first walkout, and there's been a lot of young people that are involved in engaging themselves into the realm of political activism, whether it be through their poetry or their raps, or whether it be through the plays or their photography. I think that it's important that we really do acknowledge the work that's being done, and there is a lot of work being done. And I think that we can't limit it to just seeing the work that's being done in our own backyards, but if you take a look at the world, take a look at what's going on in Cuba with the situation with Elian, mm-hmm. and people rising up and it being a lot of young people at the forefront of the movement. Take a look at what's going on in Vieques, Puerto Rico, with people saying, you know, ni una bamba más, they had enough, that they're not going to see exploitation and the raping of their country and their land and the killing of their people. And a lot of young people are at the forefront of it. And so I think that it's important that we as activists stay connected, and that we as people that are trying to continue a legacy of struggle, that we hook up with elders, and that we as young people are given room to grow and to become a part of this vanguard that we're shaping, and that we move forward knowing that, you know, we're in the right, and that this is not a new struggle, and that this is something that, a legacy that we're passing on, and that's part of the way we get our passion and our energy to continue the struggle, is through learning the history and knowing that we are the new pages of that history.
And you see the role of community radio as really fundamental to this process, I guess.
I definitely do. And community radio is one part of it, but also when you look at micro power radio, and you look at webcasting, and you look at the internet, you realize that these things can be used for tools of liberation or tools of oppression. That, you know, mainstream media is being used as a tool of oppression. But when we liberate a radio station and we see, you know, micropower radios created in communities, that's a liberating act. And it's using the same vehicle, the same vehicle, whether it be, you know, creating an alternative newspaper, using, you know, radio as a way of communicating, that these same things, if we take control of them, if we empower ourselves as communities to utilize them, can become our tools for struggle for liberation and revolution. So we need to find out how we can manipulate them for our benefits in struggle and resistance, and start to utilize them. And I think that the technology is definitely one, and I think that community radio and free speech and getting things out on the airwaves is another one. Some of the ways that people can get involved is you taking a look at some of the internet sites, www.cfdp.org. That's Coalition for Democratic Pacifica. cfdp.org. There's a lot of information as to what's going on with the strike currently at KPFA in terms of the stringers for the National News Network. And also there's information about my particular case, about what's going on. There's an online petition that almost 1,000 people have signed up for. And so that's definitely a way that people can get involved. And there's also www.freepacifica.org as well. And they have links to other places as well. And that's definitely a way to stay connected if you're not around, to know what's going on with this struggle here at KPFA.
Khalil Jacobs Fantauzi was interviewed by Steve Miller for People's Tribune Radio in Oakland, California. This is People's Tribune Radio. And we're joined by Martin Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, to talk about Jörg Haider and the Freedom Party in Austria.
Jörg Haider is the leader of the Freedom Party in Austria. The Freedom Party is a radical right-wing populist party which has openly fascist roots. As a result of a recent election in Austria, it has come to share power in a national governing coalition. And this is a very disconcerting and disturbing development to my mind, because what it does, it really legitimizes a very vicious kind of extremism, because Haider's political party really campaigned by scapegoating foreigners, scapegoating immigrants, in a way that was really out of proportion to any kind of reality. He blamed foreigners for every problem under the sun in Austria. He blamed them for juvenile delinquency and drug abuse and joblessness and prostitution, any problem under the sun. And he managed to win power as a result of by brokering a deal with the mainstream conservative party in Austria, the People's Party, and now he'll be in the government. The Austrian Freedom Party, I should point out, is one of several right-wing extremist movements in Europe that have been gaining a lot of momentum, particularly since the end of the Cold War. Haider has been leading the Freedom Party since 1986, and he is a very charismatic, very telegenic, relatively young leader, and very effective in promoting his views. And part of his effectiveness entails hiding his relationships with hardcore neo-Nazis and neo-fascists who are part of his political party.
It seems that Haider, as you so stated, is part of a spreading and growing movement in Europe, and certainly not just Europe, obviously in the United States too. Pat Buchanan comes to mind when I think of Jörg Haider, and I understand Pat Buchanan has spoke out somewhat in support of Haider, correct?
I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. They articulate very similar policies and points of view, Jörg Haider and Patrick Buchanan. Among them, they have a very skewed history of World War II. Patrick Buchanan, in his recent book, claimed that Winston Churchill, the leader of Great Britain during the war, was a war criminal. And Jörg Haider in Austria says the same thing. More to the point, in the present, they both attack foreigners, immigrants, people of color, gays and lesbians, as part of almost an anti-patriotic element in society. They both have taken strong stands against economic globalization, and that's a very, very key issue that has given a lot of mileage to Jörg Haider in Austria and his counterparts in other European countries. In Italy, you have the National Alliance. In Belgium, Vlaams Bloc. In France, the National Front. In Norway, the Progress Party. All those parties I just mentioned have gained at least 15% or more of the vote in nationwide elections. We in the United States might think, well, 15% is not that much. But in fact, in a parliamentary system such as exists in Europe, that is a very significant percentage. And it can be decisive in determining the kind of government that exists in those countries.
Why are we seeing a resurgence of these fascist, Nazi-ish parties in Europe?
I think ultimately fascism, to the extent that it is resurgent today, is a product of democratic decay. These kinds of extremist movements can really only thrive in situations where there's a great deal of social injustice, where there's a significant disparity between the wealthy and the poor. And these extreme right-wing demagogues have been able to touch a raw nerve by addressing the injustices that do actually exist in society, but they do it in a very demagogic way, in a very deceptive way, through the scapegoating and through racist rhetoric. But it has appealed to people because we're in a transition now since the end of the Cold War, a political transition. We're also in an economic transition as a result of the accelerated pace of globalization. And globalization, I think, is really a key issue here and a key factor in promoting the rise of these far-right movements for several reasons, really quickly. For starters, you know, economic globalization and the way it's playing out ends up limiting the power of nation-states to make their own economic policies to a large degree. In Europe, there's the European Union, and any member state in the European Union, including Austria, has to give up certain powers and abilities to modulate their own economies because they're all now participating in a single currency called the euro. And that means Austria can no longer set its own currency valuations. It can't adjust its own interest rates. It has to go according to the decisions that are taken either in Brussels or Frankfurt by these unelected central bankers who have enormous power. So people perceive that rightly as an infringement of sovereignty. And as a result, there's an ultra-national backlash that's been spearheaded by these extreme right groups. Part of it, of course, has to do with unemployment. And the joblessness in Europe is significantly higher, at least officially, than compared to the United States. That puts people ill at ease. It makes people anxious. But another part of the globalization also has to do with the cultural aspect, the fact that there is a kind of an encroaching global monoculture that accompanies globalization. It's sort of like a great homogenizer, where you could be in Nevada City, California, or Vienna, Austria, or Tokyo, Japan, or Timbuktu, for that matter, and you could be on a street corner in any of those places, and you're liable to see the same corporate logos, the Toyota, the McDonald's, the Walt Disney, the Coca-Cola. And that kind of uniformity of experience, people take to be somewhat threatening, as if it's eroding their own specific national and cultural identities. And right-wing demagogues speak very effectively to those anxieties. I mean, on the one hand, They're scapegoating the weakest in society. They're blaming the fact that immigrants are in a particular country, and they're depicting this as a threat to their own national identity, their cultural identity, as if Arabs from North Africa who are living in Paris or another part of France will make the French people somehow less French. I mean, that's the way it's depicted, both as a threat posed by immigration on the one hand, and also to some degree in terms of the big business and the fact that it is, in its drive to accumulate capital, is promoting a kind of sort of a cultural homogeneity and sameness that increasingly exists around the world. So it's sort of a two-pronged critique, a rather sophisticated critique in a lot of ways, and not without some elements of truth when it comes to targeting big business as the foe. The problem is when that the critique is combined with the scapegoating of those weaker in society, with women, with people of color, with immigrants, with those on welfare, with the poor. That's what Patrick Buchanan does so successfully. He will, on the one hand, target Jews, or I should say Jewish CEOs of major corporations, as if they're the enemy, they're the big business exploiters. And obviously there's truth to the fact that big business does exploit and does dominate in the United States and other parts of the world, although Patrick Buchanan somehow always manages to pick a company with a Jewish CEO to cite as an example, sending a signal there. And at the same time, he'll lambast immigrants and people of color as if they're somehow the quote-unquote lazy parasites mooching off of the hardworking middle-class white man who's caught in this vice between big business pressuring from above and the so-called lazy parasites putting pressure from below. And that's that image of a vice that is very evocative and very effective in terms of getting people to listen. And from when people are confused about their own situation, it somehow begins to make some sense. And, of course, again, there is some merit to the notion that there's a lot of merit to the notion that big business is exploiting, but I think there's very little merit to the notion that somehow middle-class people are being hurt because of the idea that the U.S. government or another government is favoring in their policies the poor over the middle class. I mean, that's ridiculous. That goes contrary to reality. We need to educate ourselves. We need to plug into independent sources of information that give a more in-depth analysis of these issues. And we need to, depending on the specific situation in one's own community, orient toward unity coalitions that are fighting hate crimes and hate groups and so forth. But, you know, in an overarching sense, I think if we dedicate ourselves to improving society in a way that is more conducive to situations for greater justice, a greater equality and distribution of wealth, a greater sense of empowerment for all people in society, in a generic sense, that will make it much more difficult for extremist groups to take root and grow, because that's their oxygen. Their oxygen is injustice. And if we lessen that injustice, these groups can't prosper.
Mr. Lee, thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure.
Martin Lee, author of the book The Beast Reawakens. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Thanks to the overwhelming response to PTR in our first year, the program is now available twice monthly and on the internet at www.ptradio.org. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies of robotics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide is used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. My name's Mike Thornton. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.